This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. In today's program, we visit Montreal, Quebec, where a major student movement is setting its sights on this week's International Economic Forum of the Americas and challenging a repressive anti-protest law in the Canadian courts. We'll speak live with Andrew Gavin Marshall. At the United Nations, the Security Council has threatened sanctions for opponents of Yemen's new government of national unity, while the Obama administration continues controversial airstrikes under the claim of destroying Al-Qaeda yet again. We'll be joined by Yemeni-American analyst Ibrahim Khattabi of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also, there is resentment and rumors of military discontent over the Obama administration's trebling of U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. We'll speak about that with Fred Bronfman, who first exposed secret American airstrikes in Laos. This is 5 o'clock shadow, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there are big moves afoot in Quebec, where there is an International Economic Forum taking place this week. Among the guests is Alan Greenspan. And the Canadian Quebecois student movement has been very active and is expected to be there. For the latest details, we're now joined live by Andrew Gavin Marshall. What is going on, Andrew?
Well, we have the International Economic Forum of the Americas, the Conference of Montreal, meeting from June 11th until Thursday, June 14th, here in Montreal in the midst of a major social crisis, social uprising known as the Maple Spring, started with a student strike but has rapidly expanded into other issues, essentially as an anti-austerity rebellion. And so there was a little protest, which I partly organized yesterday morning to welcome this gathering of international elites to the city. And, I mean, we have Alan Greenspan, our Prime Minister Stephen Harper was there, the Governor of the Bank of Canada, Mark Carney, a former executive at Goldman Sachs. We have seven other central bankers from around the world there. Quebec Premier Jean Charest was there. The Mayor of Montreal welcomed them. And it's partly hosted by the Desmarais family, who are a billionaire family here in Quebec, sort of the equivalent of Canada's Rockefellers. They are very close friends with former President George H.W. Bush, with Bill Clinton, with Nicolas Sarkozy, very comfortable in elite circles. And they're hosting this conference, financing a good portion of it through their main company, Power Corporation, and the name fits. And, of course, 25% of the funding for this conference comes from government sources, from the federal government, the Ontario provincial government, and the Quebec provincial government, which finances it to the tune of $200,000. So, of course, there is public funds to subsidize a conference hosted by billionaires, but there is no money for students. So that's really one of the issues that is drawing the students out to these protests. There was a little gathering yesterday morning, a larger one in the evening, and tomorrow at noon, as well as in the evening, there's going to be much bigger protests against this conference. The one at noon tomorrow is hosted by the largest student association class, so we're sure to see a larger crowd for that one.
What are you asking the government to do or demanding that they do in regard to this summit and the internal economics of Canada itself?
Well, it's really a question of priorities. I mean, here you have a conference bringing together, you know, all the promoters, big tank leaders, heads of universities such as Heather Monroe Blom of McGill, who's also on the board of directors of Canada's biggest bank, the Royal Bank of Canada. And you really have this conference bringing together politicians, corporate executives, media barons, bankers. You have presidents and coup leaders from African countries coming here to this conference to speak. And, of course, you have Rio Tinto Alcan, a major mining company, which is renegotiating a contract with this African coup leader. And they're all at this conference gathering to talk about promoting neoliberal policies, to to talk about promoting austerity programs. And meanwhile, the students here, as well as the wider population, are suffering under austerity programs. So it's not a conference which is representative of democracy, which is representative of the people themselves. It's a conference which represents elites and elite interests. And our elected representatives, including our Prime Minister and Quebec's Premier and Montreal's Mayor, are present at this meeting because that's their real constituency. That's the real interest that they serve. It's really about a mafiocracy, not a democracy. And the students in the streets are really promoting the concept of democracy, are struggling for actual representation, are struggling for actual rights. And there's an idea, it's perhaps at this point a very radical and controversial idea, where government should serve the people and not the powerful, where public funds should benefit the people, not billionaires. And that's really what is pushing students and others into the streets and is what is gaining ire and angst against this type of conference.
If Montreal is anything like Chicago, there must be police countermeasures against the protesters. What kind of countermeasures are in effect at the present time, and what kind of protests have there been over the past several days?
Well, the protests over the past have been fairly small scale. The police presence at yesterday morning's protest far outnumbered the amount of protesters. You had many of the riot police, the provincial riot police, the Sûreté du Québec, the SQ. You had, of course, the police on horseback. There was a very heavy police presence, we can expect that to continue. Part of the reason why the turnout was small was because over the weekend we had the F1 Formula One races in Montreal. It's perhaps the most profitable tourist event in Canada every year. And the security presence was massive. Protests were quite large throughout the weekend. And the police actions during the F1 were quite extensive, including what they called preventive arrests, where they were simply they were engaging in political profiling, because the student movement has as its symbol of solidarity a small red square, the Carré Rouge, which is a symbol of going squarely into the red, into debt. And it's the symbol of solidarity with the Quebec student movement, with the Maple Spring. And police were simply pulling people aside who were wearing this red square at the metro stations, downtown, wherever the protests were located. Police were searching the bags of people who had the red square. A couple journalists even did an experiment to see if this was true, because rumors were going around that people who were wearing the red square were getting targeted unfairly. And sure enough, the journalists were even arrested, and they asked if it was because they had the red square, and the police responded that that is, of course, true. It's a revolutionary symbol, and they're sick of people like that. These were the statements from the police. And so, of course, you had arbitrary arrests, what's called preventive arrests, which is, you know, the stuff of science fiction, what was called pre-crime in Philip K. Dick novels. These were the actions of the police over the weekend, pepper spraying, beating people, and very typical. I mean, it's not as bad as compared to a lot of the police actions in the past couple months, which have been quite violent and quite extensive, especially with Bill 78, which restricts the rights, freedoms of assembly and expression, and led to mass arrests. In one evening in Quebec, there were over nearly 700 arrests. We've even had student negotiators arrested outside of negotiations for attempting to get the police to stop arresting peaceful protesters. There has even been a member of the Quebec Assembly, a politician, who was arrested for partaking in a peaceful demonstration. So this is very consistent with police actions throughout the past 4 months.
Bill 78 is a remarkable law with very stern proscriptions against protest. Can you take a moment more to explain to people who may be coming recently to the story about how bad the repression is? And I further understand that today there were court proceedings on what to do about this law. And once identifying the terms of Bill 78, can you tell us what the legal strategy is to ameliorate these restrictive measures?
Sure. Bill 78 was passed on May 18th. It went into effect on Saturday, May 19th. It has three main facets. It suspended the school semester for the schools affected by the strike, which was an attempt to end the picket lines, an attempt to really essentially undermine and bring a so-called calm to the student protests. It also vastly restricts freedom of assembly and freedom of expression. It forbids protests from being within 50 meters of school property. And of course, in Montreal, all the main campuses are located and scattered throughout the downtown area, especially on the main street, St. Catherine. So essentially, protesting is illegal within these areas. It is required also by the bill that any demonstration of over 50 people must submit at least 8 hours beforehand an itinerary to the police, including the location, the duration, the direction, and all the details of the planned demonstration. And the police have the newfound arbitrary right to change or simply cancel anything if they please. Any protest which does not submit anything to the police 8 hours beforehand is considered illegal, and anybody taking part may be arrested under the charge of taking part in an illegal protest. The third main facet is, of course, the heavy fines for those who partake, those who lead, and the student associations involved with various protests. For people who participate, the fine could be between $1,000 and $5,000. For student leaders, between $7,000 and $35,000. And for student associations, be up to $125,000 for a first offense and $250,000 for a second offense. And this simply includes supporting or participating in a so-called illegal demonstration. Now, that's designed to essentially bankrupt the student associations. However, when the law was passed, there was such outrage against this type of bill that it really mobilized a much wider sector of the population against it. Even the very conservative Quebec Bar Association denounced the law. You had many law professors, legal experts denouncing it. We even had a march a couple weeks ago of several hundred lawyers and jurists who marched downtown Montreal in their robes against Bill 78. So it's been very controversial. It has only actually been applied a few times within the first week, within the first few days, where they are engaged in mass arrests, one of which was Catalina arresting 518 protesters, peaceful protesters in downtown Montreal, for a demonstration which was declared illegal before it began. However, because of the reaction against Bill 78 and its very unpopular appeal, you haven't seen it employed very often. For subsequent demonstrations, police have declared them illegal but said they would allow them to proceed so long as they remain peaceful. And the student association, the biggest student association class, announced immediately that it would take the issue to the courts. And, of course, there's no lack of lawyers and legal experts to help them. They have their own legal committee, of course, and today they are actually, a couple weeks ago, they brought a measure to the courts, and today they really began actions within the courts in Quebec to at least suspend specific points in Bill 78 before they can proceed with repealing it altogether. And, of course, the only praise for Bill 78, besides coming from the government itself, came from the business community, such as the Metropolitan Board of Trade of Montreal, whose president, Michel LeBlanc, instantly praised Bill 78 when it was passed as restoring order, and which is very good for the business community. Michel LeBlanc is also, of course, a speaker and guest at the International Economic Forum of the Americas this week, and So we will hopefully see portions of Bill 78 suspended, if not repealed altogether. There's no lack of support for getting rid of this law. And it technically expires on July 1st, 2013, but hopefully we will see it gone long before then.
Final question. The Quebec movement has won the imagination of the Occupy movement here in the United States and many different cities where there have been sympathy protests. I'm wondering if there is additional international reaction to the movement, such as, for instance, in Greece and Italy, going through economic distress. And are student movements in places like that also connecting with the Quebec movement?
Yes, absolutely. The most striking example outside North America is in Chile, where their student movement is just coming up to its first year anniversary and is still continuing. It's been a massive movement for over a year, gotten very little coverage in North America. But again, it's against essentially the same issues, except perhaps more. The Chilean students are struggling against essentially a privatized educational system, which allows for access for only the rich, and everybody else is essentially pushed back. And that movement has been going strong for a year, and it continues. There were protests just the other day. Students, again, it's very much an anti-austerity, anti-neoliberal movement. It's just as Quebec is called the Maple Spring, that's referred to as the Chilean winter. And there was protest just the other day against a counter demonstration against some pro-Pinochet fascist supporters who held a protest in support of the imagined legacy of Augusto Pinochet. And so there have been some exchanges between Chile and Quebec student movements. Various speakers from Quebec's movement have gone to Chile to talk about the movement here. I hear from Chilean friends that at various protests, student protests, they see people with the red square. There have Camila Vallejo, she was one of the major student leaders in the Chilean student movement, gave a statement a week or two ago in support, in solidarity with the Quebec student movement. And as you mentioned, Greece, we've seen no official statement come out, but I have been in communication with some Greek academics who are planning on getting a bunch of signatures and signing a statement of solidarity with the Quebec student movement. So that should be coming out hopefully quite soon. But certainly the momentum is there. I mean, we see the same type of thing in Spain with the Indignados, which in turn inspired the Occupy movement itself. You've seen really some mobilization with Occupy Wall Street, which has worked in coordination with the City University of New York, where students are also organizing protests against increased tuition. I saw footage from an occupation that they engaged in a couple months ago where many of the students at that school were wearing the red square. We have students starting to organize in Toronto, Ontario. So it is spreading. And certainly Quebec students express solidarity with students and struggles everywhere, and that's being returned, especially with the spread of the casseroles, the banging of the pots and pans, which has gone global.
Thank you for that roundup. We've been speaking with Andrew Gavin Marshall, live from Montreal, Quebec, where there is an international economic summit and a protest going on throughout the week. And we'll stay in touch on this story. Thank you so much today.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. Coming up, death from above in Yemen and military discontent in Pakistan.
get a job. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. Ah, but don't you believe them? Said, hey, little boy, you can't go where the others go. You don't look like they do. Said, hey, old man, how can you stand to think that way? Did you really think about it before you made the rules? He said, sure. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. Oh, but don't you believe it?
The Way It Is, Bruce Hornsby and The Range. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there are developments in Yemen today where the United Nations Security Council threatened to impose sanctions against those who are claimed to have been resisting the operations of the new so-called National Unity Government there. We're now joined live by Yemeni-American human rights activist and legal worker Ibrahim Khattabi of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to The Shadow, and what happened at the UN today?
Actually, what happened at the UN today is the UN and Full House passed a resolution which mainly has many good points. First of all, they needed the government, the current government and the former regime, to first immediately release all the illegal detained individuals who were protesting in the streets and were kidnapped and disappeared. That's one. Number two, the UN passed also another I mean, within the resolution, they have the what they call the under Chapter 7, the Sanction 41, which basically sanctions all those who damaging the political process in Yemen, and it's mainly even though it didn't list anyone, it mainly targeting the former regime and the former president Saleh and his family members who refusing to give power and refusing the presidential orders when he resigned some of the family members of former president Saleh. These some of the main points of the new resolution that are also called for unity, for a national dialogue that would include women and youth. And also, so this might have a very good outcome, even though it didn't list any groups or names of individuals to be targeted by the this resolution, but also it is a step in the right direction.
There is some celebration in some quarters over the removal of the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh. And does that mean, however, that this new government or transition is sufficient for real reform?
No, not actually, no. But this is the only government that that exists at this point, is a coalition of both the opposition's political groups and also part of the former regime. And it doesn't really represent the people, but this is the political process and the political agreement between political, groups. And so, but it's there being definitely a really great, a little bit of reform in terms of changing corrupt officials, close loyalists of the former president, and so it's a two years period where then the Yemenis will be able to elect their own elected officials.
There is another issue in Yemen, and like in so many other places, it touches upon the idea of national sovereignty, and that is the issue of the drone strikes that are underway there with the United States assistance. And the claim is repeatedly made in Washington that this is the Alamo of Al-Qaeda. This is the final stage of eliminating the organization. Is that accurate, and who is really getting hit by these airstrikes?
Well, actually, drones to begin with is completely playing to the hands of Al-Qaeda members. And it's only a tool to recruit more extremists. Many of the times, civilians and innocent people got hit by these drones. For example, in December of 2009, a place called Al-Majala, where more than two families got hit by a missile. About 40 individuals, mainly women and children, got killed by a missile, thinking that they were Al-Qaeda members. And so there's a lot of cost of lives among civilians. And it's not an effective way to counter counter Al-Qaeda. There is a problem. It seems like a real problem. The former president himself, there's a lot of reports that he was actually, using Al-Qaeda card to gain support from the West, mainly the U.S., and to actually go against his political opponents within the country and to stay in power. Obviously and clearly, within a few weeks, the new president, Hadi, was able to take more than three-thirds of the whole state called Abyan, where the claims are it's the Al-Qaeda stronghold. And so it's only one city left to be taken by the government. And so this is a clear indication that the war on Qaeda was almost not clearly a real thing, and it's basically there's a lot of evidence and that the former regime was not actually fighting Al-Qaeda, and we don't have reports really of who will guide her? Who are these individuals, the U.S. and even the Yemen, the former Yemeni government we're targeting? We don't have a list of individuals. We don't know how many people. The state of Erbil, there were four divisions of the Republican Guard surrounding the state. And how? The question is how a few individuals or hundreds of individuals were able to actually gain control over the whole state.
In the ongoing attacks, whether it be by drone or by intelligence or repression or disappearances or whatever other methodologies, are there being people targeted who are not necessarily, quote, Al-Qaeda, but who are merely political dissidents seeking progressive reform?
Obviously, the deputy governor of the state of Madrid, he was one of the main political figures in that state and was targeted, in a wrong hit, that's claiming that it was an Al-Qaeda target, and then all of a sudden it was the deputy governor of the state. So, including a lot, like I said, Al-Majala was one of the main issues where a lot of civilians, whole families were wiped out. There's no list of those who they claim to be Al-Qaeda got killed. And why don't they show their pictures? Why don't they, list their names? It is an issue. You cannot counter violence with violence. There's many ways. And thank God that that basically the Yemeni tribes don't support any extremism or terrorism in Yemen. Or otherwise, this would have been a big problem in Yemen.
Finally, we're speaking with Ibrahim Khatabi, and he's with the Center for Constitutional Rights and is himself a Yemeni-American. What about the American input into the system in Yemen? I speak specifically of the Obama administration's State Department and economic involvement. Are the initiatives coming from Washington necessarily consistent with the indigenous wishes of the people of Yemen?
Well, clearly the main support that the main aid that the U.S. government has given to Yemen is counterterrorism aid. And so what Yemenis and Yemen as a whole need, it's development. They need some sort of justice for the crimes that are committed against the peaceful protesters. And so the U.S. government has a really golden opportunity to support the democracy movement, which is they haven't done strongly. Development, youth initiative. That's the way to help Yemenis to counter extremism, to have some justice, a true democracy. This is the way Obama administration should be focusing. And I think there's something wrong with the Obama foreign policy in Yemen that needs to be changed. It needs to be more toward development. And so that's the real shift that the Obama administration needs to take on.
Where might people go to get more detailed information about circumstances in Yemen and its relationship to the entire region?
Well, the bottom line is that there is not a lot of Western reports on Yemen. Mainly the main reports, it's about Al-Qaeda, fighting Ansar al-Sharia. But they need to actually, get in contact with people in the squares, with the youth, with activists, with the NGOs in Yemen. That's the real people that will tell you the real story about Yemen. Yemen is not really; it's on the bottom of the Western bottom line of the Western media, and so it is hard to get all correct information about Yemen and the Western media. And so I suggest that people should look up the Youth Revolution websites, got in contact with about NGOs, but mainly visit the squares where millions of people been in the streets for the past a year and a half demanding democracy, freedom, equal citizenship. And that's the real face of Yemen.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Ibrahim Khatabi of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thanks for having me.
Right. machine in your group of homies. Oh, chicken patron in your home, flying, flying, predator drone.
This is 5 o'clock shadow, and we move from Yemen to another nation that is under the threat of death from above by way of the drones. And that is apparently precipitating some very deep tensions within the nation of Pakistan. We're now joined live by Fred Bronfman, who notably was the first to expose the U.S. secret bombing campaign in Laos. And welcome back, Fred. I understand you're concerned about Pakistan.
I'm very concerned, yes.
We've spoken about the drones. We've spoken about the issue of national sovereignty, but I get the impression that something deeper could possibly be brewing. Why don't you tell us all about that?
Well, I think the recent case that's described today on the front page of the New York Times is very significant. Basically, a judicial commission has found that the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, which is, of course, the most important position in the Foreign Service, was behind a memo sent to Admiral Mullen asking for U.S. intervention to prevent a coup in Pakistan after the killing of Osama bin Laden last May. Now, I take this as very serious because although they're claiming that it was a Pakistani businessman who sent the memo and that the ambassador claims he had nothing to do with it, this is not believable because obviously Admiral Mullen wouldn't pay attention to a mere memo from a Pakistani businessman living in the United States. Obviously, this came from the ambassador. And what you have, therefore, is a a very high-ranking Pakistani official worried about a coup, an anti-U.S. coup in Pakistan. And let us remember that Pakistan has the world's fastest-growing and least stable nuclear stockpile, according to all experts. So, and by the way, also today we found out that the negotiations between the government of Pakistan and the government of U.S. to allow supplies to go to the through Pakistan into Afghanistan have been suspended. So this is, I think, a moment to pause and ask ourselves, is it in the United States national security interest to befriend the nation of Pakistan, to have the nuclear-armed government of Pakistan regard us as their allies, and to work with us in apprehending al-Qaeda suspects in Pakistan, which, of course, would be far more effective if they were working with us rather than working against us? Or is it in the United States national security interest to alienate the government of Pakistan, destabilize the government to the point where a coup is considered quite serious, where the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S. considers the likelihood of an anti-U.S. coup quite seriously, where the Taliban and anti-U.S. forces have grown in strength fourfold since General Petraeus took over about 2 years ago as head of CENTCOM, where the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, the former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Ann Patterson, said in the WikiLeaks cables that we're so hated in Pakistan that the government of Pakistan is afraid to cooperate with us on safeguarding their nuclear materials, and she was very worried that nuclear materials could fall into terrorist hands. So I think it's quite clear that U.S. policy towards Pakistan is not working. It's endangering us, not protecting us. I mean, and by the way, Robert, I think it's important to remember the other big so-called crisis right now, which is over Iran getting nuclear weapons. Well, why are we so worried about Iran getting nuclear weapons right now? Because 25 years ago, the U.S. executive branch supported the Shah of Iran against the wishes of the Iranian people. There would be no Ayatollah Khomeini today if we had not supported, installed the Shah of Iran, actually, in the 50s after we overthrew the Iranian prime minister in Iran. So when we talk about the possibility of Pakistan's nuclear weapons falling into enemy hands, or we talk about a coup in Pakistan, or we talk about the Pakistani Taliban growing in strength, taking over ever portions of Pakistan, this is not a fiction or a novel. This has already happened in Iran, and it's now happening in Pakistan.
Well, according to some accounts, the Pakistani military does maintain a professional level of operation. And to me, the question is, between the parliament, the government, the prime minister, the president on the political side, and the military over the national interest side, it seems that the political process has been next to useless in terms of asserting sovereignty and control, command and control over the reckless airstrikes from NATO and the United States across the Afghanistan border and up until a recent time and perhaps to this day through CIA bases inside Pakistan. So the military then must have some additional valence in this issue, because I think there's another factor here in that the military and the intelligence agency, ISI, I think they both understand that the cultural relationships in the border region are to Pakistan's government's interest, unlike the wishes of the Obama and Bush administrations to go after the Taliban, which the United States helped create in the first place. So exactly. Is it possible that some proponents of military action might think that they have a better grip on the situation than the ineffective elected government?
I'm sorry, proponents of military action within Pakistan or U.S.?
Is it an absurd analysis, or is it a rational analysis that some people might think the military might be more effective than the politicians in controlling United States violations of Pakistani sovereignty?
Well, it's a very good question. Nobody knows about that. I see your basic situation today is the Pakistani military has a $6.4 billion budget, of which we supply $2.5 billion. So we're basically trying to buy them off. There's growing hatred of the United States within the Pakistani military, particularly among the junior officers. And by the way, the possibility of a coup was discussed on the front page of the New York Times a year and a half ago, and ever since then, there have been more and more reports of this. But the people making foreign policy in this country, and by the way, I'm extremely critical of Obama, and the problem is Romney would be even worse, as was George Bush. The people making foreign policy in this country, which is a bipartisan consensus of Republican and Democrats, are hoping that they can continue to buy off the Pakistani military over the short run. The problem is the Pakistani military also has to keep its credibility with the Pakistani people. Now, there was a military coup and they would get stronger about the United States and make them stop the drone strikes is a very interesting question. Nobody seems to know the answer to that. But one thing I think that I'd like to stress, because I think this is really the key point, is it an American interest to think short-term, in terms of short-term tactics in Pakistan, like, okay, we want to win in Afghanistan, so we're going to ignore what all of the people in Pakistan, government, military, and parliament say, and who they want us to stop the drone strikes. We're going to triple them, as Obama did in the last few months. Is that really in our interest, or should we be thinking strategically? And by that, I mean, look out over the next decade. What's going on right now is in a totally irrational, short-term-oriented, careerist perspective, the people currently making foreign policy in the United States who do not represent the wishes of the American people, as you know, the latest polls show the American people want to get out of Afghanistan by 67% to 32%, and instead they're proposing wasting another $150 to $200 billion over the next 2 years fighting in Afghanistan, the people making foreign policy. As they pursue their own short-term interests, they're turning the entire Muslim world against us, and Pakistan is the most serious situation because they do have these nuclear weapons. They're not thinking 5 and 10 years from now. And I think this is the greatest geopolitical disaster of our lifetime, what is going on right now, which is Democrats and Republicans in power in the United States are alienating ever larger numbers of the $1.8 billion strong Muslim world. Now that includes tens of millions of potential suicide bombers and anti-U.S. Taliban forces. It's destabilizing Pakistan, and I think this is just a disaster. It's hard for me to believe this is happening. You know, the question now is, okay, think about that for a moment. The Pakistani ambassador to the U.S. says to Admiral Mullen, please come into Pakistan and do a coup to prevent an anti-U.S. group of military officers from taking over, which I think is such a possibility, I'm willing to risk my career about that. Now, ask yourself the question, what would have happened if Mullen had said yes, or there was enough worry in the United States that anti-forces within the Pakistani military would do a coup? What are our options at that point? Now, the leading U.S. expert about Pakistan is Bruce Rydell. He's the fellow who was a former CIA guy. He coordinated Obama's AFPAC policy review a few months after Obama took office. In his book, he says, what could the U.S. do to prevent Pakistan from turning against us? And basically said nothing, because they have nuclear weapons. If we tried to invade Pakistan, they would use it against us. At this point, they won't even cooperate with us, the Pakistani government, according to the U.S. ambassador, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, on safeguarding a handful of nuclear materials.
That's where we're going to have to leave it today.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, anytime you want to talk about it, I think the key message is the people running American foreign policy have no idea what they're doing, and they're endangering your and my life.
Well, thank you so much. Where can people find your latest work?
Well, at Alternet, I have a piece called Why Counterterrorism is More Dangerous Than Terrorism. That's the piece and then I have two pieces on Salon, on why General Petraeus is the worst military general in post-war American history.
Well, thank you so much, Fred Bronfman, continuing on the tradition with which you first reported on the U.S. secret bombing campaign in Laos. We'll be back in touch. Thank you. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was produced with Thiago Brozo and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, tips, leaks, queries, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org or a letter to 5 O'Clock Shadow, WBAI 120 Wall Street, New York 10005. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.